Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. In 2016, states in the U.S. have executed the fewest number of people since 1991. Now, this decline stands in contrast to a growing number of executions internationally. In 2015, the global number of executions increased 54% to 1,634, according to Amnesty International. Now, one country that is executing people at a record clip is Saudi Arabia. In January, it executed 47 people in a single day. Last year, it served capital punishment on at least 158 people, about six times the number it executed in 2010. We're going to hear from a panel of experts in a few minutes about the different sides to the use of the death penalty in Saudi Arabia. But first, we're going to bring in Sunjeev Berry in Washington. He's the advocacy director for Middle East and North Africa issues at Amnesty International USA. Sunjeev, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're talking today about the use of capital punishment in Saudi Arabia in the U.S. that is used for crimes like first-degree murder. Tell us what sorts of crimes lead to the death penalty in Saudi Arabia.
In Saudi Arabia, it's an astonishing array of crimes that can lead to the death penalty. Everything from murder to apostasy and adultery, sorcery, witchcraft, highway robbery. It's a long and very strange list with many crimes that are not recognized under international law.
And so how is the death penalty used in practice? I mean, I understand the law says one thing, but who is being executed and why?
Well, the death penalty is administered in Saudi Arabia after generally extraordinarily unfair court procedures. People can be held incommunicado or detained for years on end without access to a lawyer. There are very serious and credible allegations of being tortured into signing so-called confessions. You also have examples in Saudi Arabia where, for example, those who are of the Shia minority faith in Saudi Arabia, where there have been many protests, for example, in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, many people from that community have faced the death penalty, oftentimes perhaps on trumped-up charges related to protests they've participated in against the government.
And how is it that executions are carried out in Saudi?
Well, they can be carried out through beheading. Sometimes the beheading is followed by a crucifixion. It's an extraordinarily brutal process.
And these beheadings, they're done in public, is that right?
That's right. They're public beheadings frequently and are publicized. The bodies following the quote-unquote crucifixion can be suspended from a pole publicly for others to see. It's a pretty horrendous sight.
And earlier this year, I mentioned in the introduction, there were 47 people executed on the same day. Why was there this mass execution?
Well, there have been a lot of allegations that a significant number of the people who were executed were involved in terrorist organizations or terrorist attacks. One of the prominent names of those executed was a man by the name of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. He was somebody who was a prominent cleric from the Shia community in Saudi Arabia who had been very critical of the Saudi Arabian government. Amnesty International had investigated much of what he said in his public record, and we found no credible evidence to support his involvement with any sort of violent activities. And quite frankly, there's no way to know for sure what any of the people who were executed were involved with, given Saudi Arabia's history of brutal torture and forced confessions.
And so in other words, it sounds like this Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr was a political dissident.
Yeah, definitely a political dissident. And now his nephew also faces the death penalty as well, also in the aftermath of having participated in protests against the government.
Well, earlier this month, there were also 15 people sentenced to the death penalty in Saudi Arabia, allegedly for spying for Iran. What do we know about that case?
Yeah, this death sentence, mass death sentence, just came down a couple days ago. In that particular case, the people who have been sentenced to death were accused of spying for Iran. They were also accused of other, you know, so-called crimes that none of us would consider crimes. For example, spreading the Shia faith, being in possession of banned books. These were some of the other examples of the charges they faced in the process of their death sentences. Once again, we have no way of knowing if anyone who was convicted of these quote-unquote crimes was actually guilty of anything, given Saudi Arabia's history of torture and forced confessions. But even if they were convicted, the death penalty should be abolished in Saudi Arabia. It's a brutal practice and a violation of the right to life.
And we mentioned in the introduction that last year Saudi Arabia executed a record number of people. This year it's on track to perhaps match that. This is substantially more than 5 or 6 years ago. So why are they executing? Why are they using the capital punishment so much more there?
Well, one of the things worth noting is that many of the death sentences are coming through these specialized criminal courts, the SCC. This court system was set up supposedly to handle terrorism offenses. Now, many of the people being convicted in these courts are political dissidents, critics of the government, that sort of thing. And so what we're seeing is a larger pattern, including the death penalty as well as long prison sentences, for people who are critical of the government, who are trying to set up organizations that are peacefully calling for reform in Saudi Arabia, a wide range of behaviors that anyone outside of the Saudi government would consider normal participation in civil society.
And if you just look at the countries that execute the most people in the world, China is number one, Iran, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia are in the top four. What's sort of different about the Saudi system?
Well, the systems are, of course, all different from each other. With Saudi Arabia, the use of the death penalty, you know, falls in the direction of this sort of application of what they consider to be Sharia law. But in the context of a brutal judicial system in which people can be tortured until they confess, you have a similar practices in Iran. In China, we don't actually know how many thousands of people are executed because many of the executions and the total number of executions are considered state secrets. So in China, for example, Amnesty International has pointed out the well over 1,000 executions that happened last year, but the reality is probably thousands higher. And then, of course, the United States is on that list as well of the top executioners in the world, though at a number that's much less than what's happening in China.
And your group and others obviously have been doing advocacy on this issue. What sort of international pressure has been brought to bear on Saudi Arabia on this issue, and has it had any effect?
Well, Amnesty International is calling on Saudi Arabia to be suspended from the UN Human Rights Council, both because of its internal behavior in terms of massive human rights violations, and also because of its massive bombardment of civilians next door in the country of Yemen. You know, so there's a rising tide of criticism around the world. In the United States, members of Congress are now more vocal in calling for a suspension of U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia. But clearly much more needs to be done. It's too easy for a succession of U.S. presidents, President George W. Bush, President Obama. We'll see where President-elect Trump takes this. It's too easy for American presidents to align themselves with the Saudi monarchy and pay no attention to what's happening inside the country.
Sanjeev Berry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Today we're talking about the use of the death penalty in Saudi Arabia, where executions have been rising, along with criticism from human rights groups. To learn more, we're going to bring in three other people who have been following this issue closely. From London, we're joined by Maya Foa. She's the director of the death penalty team at Reprieve, a rights group that advocates for the abolition of the death penalty. In Chicago is Delphine Lorteau. She's executive director of the Cornell Center on the Death Penalty Worldwide. And in Allendale, Michigan, is Sebastian Mizell. He's an associate professor of Arabic and Middle East Studies at Grand Valley State University and has done research in Saudi Arabia on this issue. Welcome to all of you. Maya Foa, let me start with you. Your organization has been particularly critical of the way these cases are handled in the Saudi courts. Can you sort of walk us through how someone goes from being arrested to being sentenced to death in Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely. Well, let me give you one example of many that we've seen that are deeply troubling. Recent case of a young man who was actually pulled out of school. He was 17 years old. He was dragged from school by police forces. He was then tortured brutally into confessing to charges that I think he never saw his confession. And then he was sentenced to death. And this is a man who was actually executed, very sadly, among the 47 of those who were executed on the 2nd of January. We hadn't known about his case at the time. We knew about the three other juveniles, including the one you see on your screen now, Ali Al-Nimr. This young man, Ali Al-Rib, was executed. His family didn't know anything about what had happened until after the news was posted of his execution. There are other issues we see systemically aside from brutal use of torture, charges such as charges that are we wouldn't consider things to be a crime, such as inviting people to protest on your BlackBerry, as on Ali al-Nimr's charge sheet. We've also seen administering first aid at a protest on charge sheets. People are routinely deprived of lawyers. Lawyers are deprived of access to their clients, are deprived of the evidence. They're not given the evidence in advance of the trial. The trials are secretive. There are manifest problems really from start to finish. And the specialized criminal courts just add another dimension, another set of problems to an already very flawed system that clearly disadvantages the people who are being accused of these so-called crimes.
Well, if I could stop you there, I wanted to turn this to Delphine Lortot then to ask just a bit about the judicial system in Saudi Arabia. How are judges trained? What are sort of their guidelines for administering the death penalty?
Well, there's a tremendous degree, as far as we know, and once again, the process is very secretive, there's a tremendous degree of influence, is one way to put it, by the executive power in judicial decisions, especially when it comes to cases that are politically sensitive, such as the cases that we've been talking about involving members of the Shia minority. So there is, you know, in addition to all of the issues that Maya just outlined, a very clear sense that trials are not fair and that outcomes may, in some political cases especially, be predetermined.
And Sebastian Maizel, we heard Sunjeev Berry talking at the top of the show about the use of public beheadings. I understand that adultery can be punished by public stonings. What is the basis for these punishments in Islamic law or traditional law? It's often talked about as being part of Sharia law, but of course there are many Muslim countries, Muslim nations, who don't have public beheadings or use the death penalty anywhere near as frequently as it happens in Saudi Arabia.
Well, Sharia law and the death penalty in general, they have a long history in the region, in particular in Saudi Arabia. The country has a legal system that is well established for, we can always say, centuries, and as being a practice that communities adhered to and supported to, that authorities implied as well. So we actually see that these kind of punishments, bodily punishment, physical punishments, has been used for generations, and they're deeply embedded. And so, yes, there's a long list of crimes that, according to Saudi legal understanding, deserve the punishment and deserve capital punishment as well.
And Maya Foa, you had been touching on earlier this sort of unusual aspect of the use of the death penalty there, and that it allows for the execution of people who are under 18 or who committed crimes when they were under 18. Why is that something that's permitted?
Well, it's an interesting question. The Saudi authorities have recently said to the Committee on the Rights of the Child that the age of majority is actually 18, and they're trying to argue that they do not sentence to death people who committed crimes when they were under 18. The fact is, we have a long documented series of cases where they have indeed sentenced people as young as 14, 15 years old to execution, and those people have subsequently been executed. And indeed, in other documents presented to the UN, there is acknowledgement of the fact that minors are sometimes sentenced to death. So why they are yet to honour the promise that they've made to the UN, I think that's yet to be seen. And we have an obligation, the international community, the US and the UK in particular, who have this very close relationship with Saudi Arabia, I think we have an obligation to really hold them to the standard that they have now said that they are upholding.
And you had mentioned this case of Ali al-Nimr, who was 17 years old, had taken part in some of the Arab Spring protests, has been sentenced to death by beheading and then crucifixion. What's the status of his case?
Well, Ali al-Nimr, like two of the other juveniles whose cases we work on who were sentenced to death following the Arab Spring protests, he was not executed. He was not among the 47 to be executed on the 2nd of January this year. However, his sentence has not been commuted, so he could actually be executed at any time. So, of course, his family are deeply distressed and concerned, and what we as organizations who work on this issue and support those individuals are calling for, and what we hope the international community will call for, is a full commutation of the sentence of these juveniles who should never have been arrested, should never have been charged, let alone sentenced to death or crucifixion.
And Delphine Lorteau, another aspect of Saudi law is that it does allow for the use of the death penalty for adultery. I believe it was last year there was a Sri Lankan maid who had been working in Saudi Arabia, had been given the death sentence for adultery. Her lover was sentenced to 100 lashings. Obviously, there's a huge imbalance there. Talk to us about how this law is applied, because obviously in a country of millions and millions of people, there have to be adultery has to be happening frequently, and yet it's not prosecuted frequently, it seems.
Yeah, so that's another interesting question. The laws that that punish adultery with death are actually surrounded by very stringent evidentiary requirements in Sharia legal tradition. There is a requirement that there be four eyewitnesses to the act of adultery in order to secure a conviction and therefore a death sentence. We believe that this requirement is not met in such cases. That being said, the punishment of stoning, which because of its particularly horrifying aspects is widely publicized, has not in fact been carried out in several years in Saudi Arabia. And the sentence of stoning that you just referred to was in fact commuted at the end of last year. That doesn't mean that it's not an ongoing concern that such sentences should be possible. And they, of course, do violate international law on several grounds. First of all, because adultery is not a crime that is recognized as such, let alone one that meets international legal standards for one of the most serious crimes that could feasibly legally be punished by death. And also because the punishment, the form of execution itself, whether it's stoning or beheading, which is the method most often used by Saudi Arabia, is illegal under international law as a contravention on the prohibition against torture.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're talking today about the rising number of executions in Saudi Arabia, where not only those convicted of murder, but political dissidents or those accused of witchcraft can be publicly beheaded. We're joined by Maya Foa of the anti-death penalty group Reprieve, Delphine Lorteau of the Cornell Center on the Death Penalty Worldwide, and Sebastian Meisel of Grand Valley State University in Michigan. For more Global Journalist content, you can visit our website, globaljournalist.org. There you'll find our ongoing coverage of underreported international issues and human rights violations. You can also check out Global Journalist on Facebook or Twitter, or subscribe to the videocast of this program on YouTube. Sebastian Meisel, I wanted to turn to you because I know you've done some research in Saudi Arabia on this issue. Do you have a sense as to how widespread public support is there for this practice?
This is a very good question, and this actually leads me to commenting on some of the things that were said earlier. I think it was Sanjeev who recommended that perhaps we should abolish the death penalty in Saudi Arabia. We need to understand that the legal system of Saudi Arabia is actually based on Sharia law, and Sharia law has some sort of a divine legitimacy. So calling to abolish a death penalty that's part of Sharia would actually go against divine will. And from my experience living, working, and in doing research in Saudi Arabia, I actually found that there is a tremendous support of the legal system and the application of particular punishments for certain horrendous crimes among the population.
And Maya Foa, Sebastian says there is significant support for the death penalty in Saudi Arabia. What's your take? Does that undermine some of the arguments against the use of it in some way?
No, I think Sebastian makes a very good point. And what's been interesting in Saudi Arabia, and I work on Saudi Arabia, but also we see it all over the world. You can think that you support the death penalty in principle, And you can hold that belief quite strongly. And then you can be presented with a case such as that of Ali al-Nimr or Ali al-Rib, who was the child who was torn out of school and then executed on the 2nd of January this year. And my understanding is, from my colleagues who are on the ground in Saudi Arabia, is that actually there isn't support for the executions of juveniles who are sentenced to death for nothing more than attending protests and who are then subsequently executed after torture and an incredibly unfair trial process. I think there are other crimes that are punishable by death in Saudi Arabia where public support may actually not go in favour of the death penalty for those crimes. So we look at the non-lethal offences. We've got a lot of drug offences. We've got, of course, attendance at protests, adultery. The moment you get into the detail of those cases, the Indonesian migrant worker who was sentenced to death for, in self-defense, killing the man who was trying to rape her, who was also her employer, I think those stories are heard much more sympathetically than we would be led to believe if we say just simply that the Saudi population is pro-death penalty. I think it's more nuanced than that. I think there are ways of restricting the death penalty that would be supported by a large majority of people in Saudi Arabia if the right cases are highlighted and the real flaws, systemic flaws in the process, are also brought to light.
And Delphine Lorto, there have been a handful of executions of people convicted of sorcery or witchcraft in the past few years in Saudi Arabia. What do we know about these cases? How is it that the capital punishment is used for it?
Well, I think this really goes back to what Maya was just saying about how certain types of offenses might benefit from public support when it comes to handing down death sentences, but others might not. And in witchcraft and sorcery cases, we really have a combination of different views, different approaches. On the one hand, you can have fear of these superstitious types of behaviors. But on the other hand, in a modern state, there's a large part of the population that recognizes that this might not be the type of offense which the state should be punishing. I also wanted to add on just to what Maya was saying earlier, that not only if you looked in more nuance at the public support for the death penalty, would you find that there is less support than one might believe for the execution of juveniles, but that the Saudi government has recognized this in its official policy, not only in its declarations towards before UN bodies, but also in the commitments that it has agreed to under international law. So Saudi Arabia has ratified the Arab Charter on Human Rights, which explicitly prohibits the execution of people who are under the age of 18 at the time of the offense. And it has also ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which similarly prohibits the use of death sentences on children. And so we see a convergence of both social values and legal obligations that should deliver results when it comes to at least these cases of juveniles being sentenced to death.
Well, Sebastian Maizel, let me turn this to you because Saudi Arabia's current king, King Salman, took power in early 2015, and that has sort of coincided with a big spike in the use of capital punishment in Saudi Arabia. Are the two related? Is this change coming from sort of the top of the Saudi government? What do we know about the involvement of the king, the monarchy, in these types of decisions?
As we heard, the application of the death penalty or granting the death penalty for certain crimes is a lengthy process. So my assumption here is that everyone who was convicted this year, this has been based on crimes being committed several years ago. And so I cannot make that immediate connection that we have a new king now and he wants to establish himself perhaps. And then he becomes more pro-death penalty. So this seems to me more of a larger general process, which we addressed earlier with regards to issues of terrorism, security issues, the international perception of that as well. And I want to go back briefly to my comment on the acceptance of the death penalty. We all know that there is also a way of getting around the death penalty in certain cases. And this is actually very popular or very strongly supported by the Saudi populace when, let's say, for example, a murderer is handed down the death penalty, but then the family of the victim pardons the killer or the murderer. So these are some aspects here that require a certain time, a certain involvement of institutions. So the legal system, I feel, and this is not my personal opinion, this is more of an observation as a scholar of the region, is actually well established, has a long tradition, and includes certain features that allow for clemency, that allow for pardons. There are several layers in the court system. It has to go all the way up to the king, who has the final decisions on these matters. But I cannot say that we have a new king that this automatically translates into a larger number of death penalties.
Well, Maya Foa, a significant share, as we'd heard earlier, a significant share of the people that are being executed in Saudi Arabia are migrant workers from South Asia, Southeast Asia. We'd heard the case raised of the Indonesian maid who was being raped by her employer or may have killed him in self-defense. Why is it that migrant workers are such a significant share of those executed?
Well, this is an extremely vulnerable population. You have economically impoverished individuals who travel over to Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the region to seek work. And there's both the domestic workers from Southeast Asia and also a lot of South Asians who go over to work on construction projects. And really significant numbers of those individuals do end up being sentenced to death. And it's an indictment. It's a terrible situation for us to see. On the other hand, what's interesting is that the governments, the home governments of these people, so we mentioned the Indonesian example. Indonesia is actually prohibiting these groups of individuals from traveling to Saudi Arabia because of the executions of large numbers of Indonesian nationals, Indonesian maids who are working in Saudi Arabia. So it's certainly a persecuted group, a targeted group, I think largely because of their vulnerability. Capital punishment is often a tool of the powerful to suppress those less powerful, and I think that's what we see here. But hopefully, again, this is an area where the international community can make a difference by highlighting those cases and really trying to put an end to these abuses.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Sanjeev Berry, Maya Foa, Sebastian Meisel, and Delphine Lortau for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Mengchen Jin, Eloise Spilliers, and Bryce Arthur. Our visuals editor is Anadil Iftikhar. Vera Tan is our supervising producer, and Pat Akers is our audio engineer. Our director is Travis McMillan of the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I want to remind our listeners to join us again next week, where we'll be discussing the rise of nationalism in Europe and around the world. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.